Chapter 10. Little away from him, signs of disturbance began to appear in her neat velvet bodice, round the region of the brooch. She made no reply. Vendale pressed the question without mercy. Can you guess what the one Swiss impression is which I have not told you yet? Her face turned back towards him, and a faint smile trembled on her lips. An impression of the mountains, perhaps? She said slyly. No, a much more precious impression than that. Of the lakes? No, the lakes have not grown dearer and dearer in remembrance to me every day. The lakes are not associated with my happiness in the present, and my hopes in the future. Marguerite, all that makes life worth having hangs, for me, on a word from your lips. Marguerite, I love you. Her head drooped as he took her hand. He drew her to him, and looked at her. The tears escaped from her downcast eyes, and fell slowly over her cheeks. Oh, Mr. Vendale, she said sadly, it would have been kinder to have kept your secret. Have you forgotten the distance between us? It can never, never be. There can be but one distance between us, Marguerite, a distance of your making. My love, my darling, there is no higher rank in goodness, there is no higher rank in beauty, than yours. Come, whisper the one little word which tells me you will be my wife. She sighed bitterly. Think of your family, she murmured, and think of mine. Vendale drew her a little nearer to him. If you dwell on such an obstacle as that, he said, I shall think but one thought, I shall think I have offended you. She started, and looked up. Oh, no! She exclaimed innocently. The instant the words passed her lips, she saw the construction that might be placed on them. Her confession had escaped her in spite of herself. A lovely flush of color overspread her face. She made a momentary effort to disengage herself from her lover's embrace. She looked up at him entreatingly. She tried to speak. The words died on her lips, in the kiss that Vendale pressed on them. Let me go, Mr. Vendale, she said faintly. Call me George. She laid her head on his bosom. All her heart went out to him at last. George, she whispered. Say you love me. Her arms twined themselves gently round his neck. Her lips, timidly touching his cheek, murmured the delicious words, I love you. In the moment of silence that followed, the sound of the opening and closing of the house door came clear to them through the wintry stillness of the street. Marguerite started to her feet. Let me go, she said. He has come back. She hurried from the room, and touched Madame Dor's shoulder in passing. Madame Dor woke up with a loud snort, looked first over one shoulder, and then over the other, peered down into her lap, and discovered neither stockings, worsted, nor darning needle in it. At the same moment, footsteps became audible ascending the stairs. Mon Dieu, said Madame Dor, addressing herself to the stove, and trembling violently. Vendale picked up the stockings and the ball, and huddled them all back in a heap over her shoulder. Mon Dieu, said Madame Dor, for the second time, as the avalanche of worsted poured into her capacious lap. The door opened, and a Benreiser came in. His first glance round the room showed him that Marguerite was absent. What, he exclaimed, my niece is away? My niece is not here to entertain you in my absence? This is unpardonable. I shall bring her back instantly. Vendale stopped him. I beg you will not disturb Miss Benreiser, he said. You have returned, I see, without your friend? My friend remains, and consoles our afflicted compatriot. A heart-rending scene, Mr. Vendale. The household gods at the pawnbroker's, the family immersed in tears. We all embraced in silence. My admirable friend alone possessed his composure. He sent out, on the spot, for a bottle of wine. Can I say a word to you in private, Mr. Benreiser? Assuredly. He turned to Madame Dor. My good creature, you are sinking for want of repose. Mr. Vendale will excuse you. Madame Dor rose, and set forth sideways on her journey from the stove to bed. She dropped a stocking. Vendale picked it up for her, and opened one of the folding doors. She advanced a step, and dropped three more stockings. Vendale, stooping to recover them as before, Abenreezer interfered with profuse apologies, and with a warning look at Madame Dor. Madame Dor acknowledged the look, by dropping the whole of the stockings in a heap, and then shuffling away panic-stricken from the scene of disaster. Abenreezer swept up the complete collection fiercely in both hands. "Go!" he cried, giving his prodigious handful a preparatory swing in the air. Madame Dor said, "Mon Dieu," and vanished into the next room, pursued by a shower of stockings. "What must you think, Mr. Vendale," said Abenreezer, closing the door, "of this deplorable intrusion of domestic details? For myself, I blush at it. We are beginning the new year as badly as possible. Everything has gone wrong tonight. Be seated, pray, and say, what may I offer you? Shall we pay our best respects to another of your noble English institutions? It is my study to be, what you call, jolly. I propose a grog." Vendale declined the grog with all needful respect for that noble institution. "I wish to speak to you on a subject in which I am deeply interested," he said. "You must have observed, Mr. Abenreezer, that I have, from the first, felt no ordinary admiration for your charming niece. You are very good. In my niece's name, I thank you. Perhaps you may have noticed, latterly, that my admiration for Miss Abenreezer has grown into a tenderer and deeper feeling, shall we say friendship, Mr. Vendale? Say love and we shall be nearer to the truth." Abenreezer started out of his chair. The faintly discernible beat, which was his nearest approach to a change of color, showed itself suddenly in his cheeks. "You are Miss Abenreezer's guardian," pursued Vendale. "I ask you to confer upon me the greatest of all favors. I ask you to give me her hand in marriage." Abenreezer dropped back into his chair. "Mr. Vendale," he said, "you petrify me." "I will wait," rejoined Vendale, "until you have recovered yourself." "One word before I recover myself. You have said nothing about this to my niece?" "I have opened my whole heart to your niece. And I have reason to hope..." "What?" interposed Abenreezer. "You have made a proposal to my niece, without first asking for my authority, to pay your addresses to her?" He struck his hand on the table, and lost his hold over himself for the first time in Vendale's experience of him. "Sir," he exclaimed, indignantly, "what sort of conduct is this? As a man of honor, speaking to a man of honor, how can you justify it?" "I can only justify it as one of our English institutions," said Vendale quietly. "You admire our English institutions. I can't honestly tell you, Mr. Abenreezer, that I regret what I have done. I can only assure you that I have not acted in the matter with any intentional disrespect towards yourself." This said, "May I ask you to tell me plainly what objection you see to favoring my suit?" "I see this immense objection," answered Abenreezer, "that my niece and you are not on a social equality together. My niece is the daughter of a poor peasant, and you are the son of a gentleman. You do us an honor," he added, lowering himself again gradually to his customary polite level, "which deserves, and has, our most grateful acknowledgments. But the inequality is too glaring, the sacrifice is too great. You English are a proud people, Mr. Vendale. I have observed enough of this country to see that such a marriage as you propose would be a scandal here. Not a hand would be held out to your peasant wife, and all your best friends would desert you." "One moment," said Vendale, interposing on his side. "I may claim, without any great arrogance, to know more of my country people in general, and of my own friends in particular, than you do. In the estimation of everybody whose opinion is worth having, my wife herself would be the one sufficient justification of my marriage. If I did not feel certain, observe, I say certain, that I am offering her a position which she can accept without so much as the shadow of a humiliation I would never, cost me what it might, have asked her to be my wife. Is there any other obstacle that you see? Have you any personal objection to me?" Abenrezer spread out both his hands in courteous protest. "Personal objection," he exclaimed. "Dear sir, the bare question is painful to me. We are both men of business," pursued Vendale, "and you naturally expect me to satisfy you that I have the means of supporting a wife. I can explain my pecuniary position in two words. I inherit from my parents a fortune of £20,000. In half of that sum I have only a life interest, to which, if I die, leaving a widow, my widow succeeds. If I die, leaving children, the money itself is divided among them, as they come of age. The other half of my fortune is at my own disposal, and is invested in the wine business. I see my way to greatly improving that business. As it stands at present, I cannot state my return from my capital embarked at more than £1,200 a year. Add the yearly value of my life interest, and the total reaches a present annual income of £1,500. I have the fairest prospect of soon making it more. In the meantime, do you object to me on pecuniary grounds?" Driven back to his last entrenchment, Abenrezer rose, and took a turn backwards and forwards in the room. For the moment, he was plainly at a loss what to say or do next. "Before I answer that last question," he said, after a little close consideration with himself, "I beg leave to revert for a moment to Miss Marguerite. You said something just now which seemed to imply that she returns the sentiment with which you are pleased to regard her?" "I have the inestimable happiness," said Vendale, "of knowing that she loves me." Abenrezer stood silent for a moment, with the film over his eyes, and the faintly perceptible beat becoming visible again in his cheeks. "If you will excuse me for a few minutes," he said, with ceremonious politeness, "I should like to have the opportunity of speaking to my niece." With those words, he bowed, and quitted the room. Left by himself, Vendale's thoughts, as a necessary result of the interview thus far, turned instinctively to the consideration of Abenrezer's motives. He had put obstacles in the way of the courtship. He was now putting obstacles in the way of the marriage, a marriage offering advantages which even his ingenuity could not dispute. On the face of it, his conduct was incomprehensible. What did it mean? Seeking, under the surface, for the answer to that question and remembering that Abenrezer was a man of about his own age, also, that Marguerite was, strictly speaking, his half-niece only, Vendale asked himself, with a lover's ready jealousy, whether he had a rival to fear, as well as a guardian to conciliate. The thought just crossed his mind, and no more. The sense of Marguerite's kiss still lingering on his cheek reminded him gently that even the jealousy of a moment was now a treason to her. On reflection, it seemed most likely that a personal motive of another kind might suggest the true explanation of Abenrezer's conduct. Marguerite's grace and beauty were precious ornaments in that little household. They gave it a special social attraction and a special social importance. They armed Abenrezer with a certain influence in reserve, which he could always depend upon to make his house attractive, and which he might always bring more or less to bear on the forwarding of his own private ends. Was he the sort of man to resign such advantages as were here implied, without obtaining the fullest possible compensation for the loss? A connection by marriage with Vendale offered him solid advantages, beyond all doubt. But there were hundreds of men in London with far greater power and far wider influence than Vendale possessed. Was it possible that this man's ambition secretly looked higher than the highest prospects that could be offered to him by the alliance now proposed for his niece? As the question passed through Vendale's mind, the man himself reappeared to answer it, or not to answer it, as the event might prove. A marked change was visible in Abenrezer when he resumed his place. His manner was less assured, and there were plain traces about his mouth of recent agitation which had not been successfully composed. Had he said something, referring either to Vendale or to himself, which had raised Marguerite's spirit, and which had placed him, for the first time, face to face with a resolute assertion of his niece's will. It might or might not be. This only was certain: he looked like a man who had met with a repulse. "I have spoken to my niece," he began. "I find, Mr. Vendale, that even your influence has not entirely blinded her to the social objections to your proposal." "May I ask," returned Vendale, "if that is the only result of your interview with Miss Abenreezer?" A momentary flash leapt out through the Abenreezer film. "You are master of the situation," he answered, in a tone of sardonic submission. "If you insist on my admitting it, I do admit it in those words. My niece's will and mine used to be one, Mr. Vendale. You have come between us, and her will is now yours. In my country, we know when we are beaten, and we submit with our best grace. I submit, with my best grace, on certain conditions. Let us revert to the statement of your pecuniary position. I have an objection to you, my dear sir, a most amazing, a most audacious objection, from a man in my position to a man in yours." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.